Hi, everybody, and thanks for joining us again for another edition of the Student Press Law Center podcast. The SPLC podcast is a monthly rundown of news and developments about the law impacting the rights of people working in and around student journalism at all levels, learning it, teaching it, and practicing it. The Student Press Law Center is a nonprofit advocate for the rights of student journalists, and you can read more about our work on our website, www.splc.org. And we always invite your comments and questions at splc@splc.org. We're here today to talk about an issue that, like many issues of access, equally impacts on the college media and the professional news media. And we'll be talking to an attorney, Kevin Goldberg, who represents a number of professional news media clients as they seek access to news events of importance to their audience. In particular, we're talking about access to sporting events and athletic competitions, events of undoubtedly high audience interest, and how newfound restrictions on what journalists can do with the photos they shoot and the video they record may be impacting on the audience and impacting on news organizations' ability to offer complete, thorough coverage. Kevin Goldberg is an attorney with Fletcher Heald Hildreth. It's a law firm based up here in the Washington, D.C. area that, among other specialties, works in the area of communications and First Amendment law. Kevin Goldberg's writing can be found on the ComLaw blog, that is commlawblog.com. He represents the American Society of News Editors, the Association of Alternative News Media, and a number of other journalism clients, and we're happy to have him today to talk with us about access to sporting events and about restrictions on sports credentials. So thanks for being here, Kevin. And I guess just sort of get us started with that issue. What have your clients in the news media been experiencing when it comes to whether it is athletic conferences, whether it's particular colleges, whether it's the NCAA, trying to restrict their ability to gather and distribute news out of sporting events? And is this something that you've maybe seen has been exacerbated by the move to the immediacy of electronic media like Twitter?
Well, thanks, Frank. I'm really excited to be here. I love working with the Student Press Law Center and the Student Press. In addition to what you said, I teach a class at an undergraduate university in media law. So I'm a big supporter of everything you do, and really happy to be
Great.
Here. On the podcast today. It's more than, in fact, though, just the immediacy of the internet. It's the ability of the internet to break down the historical partnership between news media and the institutions they cover. Mm-hmm. So the internet has had a dual effect. As you note, there is an immediacy of the internet. People can provide updates in real time that many of the universities and other institutions, the teams, the leagues, the events, don't want to, you know, to have put out in real time because they feel it impacts their broadcast rights. It's a bit of a stretch, I believe, for people to claim that, you know, a bunch of Twitter updates are an adequate substitute for watching a game live. But that's generally one of the claims that's made, or the ability to monetize their own Twitter account would be another one. But that brings us into the second issue. Historically, as I said, there was always this partnership aspect between a team, a sport, a league, an event, an institution, and the media covering them. They relied on each other. If you want to, you know, break it down to its basics, the media needed the content to cover, the event to cover, and the event or the league or the team needed the media to cover it and provide that sort of advertising in a way. Now that's gone, especially with the internet. And in fact, with cable channels, you see the conferences, as we know, setting up their own cable channels. You see every institution, every league having its own television channel sometimes for big institutions, signing, as Notre Dame has, you know, a football contract or a football television contract. The University of Texas apparently was in discussions for one of these, but also certainly having their own website to push out their own online stories, the equivalent to print stories. And in fact, they're, you know, at the pro level, they're often recruiting away the people from the local media to write for the league's or the team's own website. And so that's a bit of a problem. At the college level, I think it's, you know, traditionally you had the SID on one side putting out information to the school newspaper and the local media on the other. Well, now the SID or the institution has its own journalism site.
Right.
It's doing more than just issuing press releases or making people available. They're writing their own you know, stories about the events and providing their own photos and their own videos and their own Twitter feeds and their own Facebook accounts and engaging in that way. And so not only do we not have the same symbiotic relationship, we have an out-and-out competition. That's what is driving most of the changes. And the changes themselves tend to be things that govern ownership or priority access to individuals, events, and content. So some of the bigger things we see when a reporter applies for credentials, therefore trying to get that primary access, are the things that they have to give up have increased. And they increase in terms of an agreement for some reason that every photo you take, every piece of video you shoot is actually the property of the event or the team you're covering, not you. They give
Wow.
you a license that says you get to use it for news and editorial purposes only, and they construe that very narrowly. They want to keep the commercialized aspects for themselves. Another one would be to say you can only use certain material, certain limited amount of the materials. There may be, whether it is an outright ban on more than 3 minutes of video in a given day from team facilities. We saw the NFL institute that one, actually no more than 2 minutes, 45 seconds of video from team facilities. And that just wasn't games, that was practices, that was press events. Anything happening on the official site was limited to two minutes, 45 seconds, and had to be taken down the next day. We see limits on the amount of photos that can be posted during a game. We see limits on the amount of updates. I mean, in the most obvious sense, tweets that could occur describing action in the game. We see limitations that say that nobody other than broadcast media who already have broadcast rights can stream any video of game action. And even then, they can only do it as part of you know, the online presence of an already authorized television program. So the coaches program midweek is basically the only program or that can use online video from a game. These are three very stark limitations we've seen in recent years.
Right, and it seems like this is the combination of, as you say, both the increased sense of competition in which the leagues or even the schools are now considering themselves to be content creators and content providers who would like to have the eyeballs on their site, and at the same time, just the ease with which members of the news media can actually distribute information in a much less costly and manner without any of the technological barriers. And the idea that one could actually live blog a sporting event in such a way that it would in any way approximate actually listening to or watching the sporting event would have been totally ridiculous 6 or 7 years ago until Twitter came along. Now it's at least theoretically possible, although I can't imagine very many people would tell you that following a tweet stream of the Super Bowl was just as good as watching it, or that many of them elected to follow it on Twitter rather than following it in their living rooms.
No, and you know, as someone who follows his alma mater and their sports program on Twitter, I can tell you that it's a nice substitute when I don't have access to the actual broadcast, but when I do have that access and I want to watch the game, you better believe I'm watching the game. I'm not following the James Madison University sports feed at that point. I'm watching the game because you're right. That's the experience, isn't it? So it's really frustrating in that sense, made more frustrating by the fact that they're actually singling out media and trying to prevent members of the media from doing things that they could do as private citizens. I mean, it's one thing to say to a reporter, you're not allowed to live blog this game. You're not allowed to provide more than 20 tweets during each half. But they wouldn't make that same claim to me sitting at home in my house watching the game. They'd have no way to prevent me from doing that.
Sure.
Frankly, would have very little way to prevent that reporter from doing it. Or in some sense, if I were in the arena, they still couldn't prevent me from doing that. So it's really not only frustrating as a matter of practice, but frustrating as just sort of an intellectual exercise. You just,
right.
You can't really get through to the NCAA or some of these other institutions to explain that to them because they're so hyper-focused now on controlling the message and controlling the money.
Right. Well, and of course, when you're dealing with, let's say, the NFL or the NBA, you're dealing with an entirely private business enterprise, an entirely private corporation, and you wouldn't even be able to get out of the starting blocks on any type of a First Amendment theory because they're not subject to the Constitution as a non-governmental actor. But when you're dealing with a University of Texas or you're dealing with a conference that's comprised wholly or almost entirely of public institutions, then you've at least arguably got some state action there, and state action is the essential prerequisite to bringing a First Amendment claim. So I guess, is it at least possible that there is a First Amendment issue lurking here, particularly, as you say, where, let's say, certain classes of attendees, certain classes of observers are singled out for differential enforcement of the rules?
In theory, yes. The idea that a public university, you made reference, for instance, to certain conferences that have a high quota of public universities. Well, the most powerful conference, I think, right now to a lot of people is the Southeastern Conference because they just keep winning every year at football.
Right.
And all but one of those schools, Vanderbilt, I believe, all but, you know, even with the expansion, all but one of them, I believe, is still a public institution. So that's where a lot of efforts have been focused in recent years. In reality, however, it still hasn't gotten a lot of traction. No lawsuit has been brought against the public universities in that sense. But we've seen similar lawsuits get brought at the high school level where, you know, may or may not surprise some of the people listening, this goes way below professional leagues, even high-powered college conferences and teams, all the way down to the high school. We've seen
sure, there's money
the
to be made.
League,
there's viewers at stake
here.
You can definitely see where something like a high school football championship could be worth real money.
Yeah, and that's where we've seen some challenges. Gannett has tried to, Gannett has fought this fight in a couple different states now, in Wisconsin and other with other newspaper organizations in Illinois as well, and we've seen two adverse rulings now which say, well, you know, this isn't a First Amendment problem, the fact that these are public high schools notwithstanding. It's not about providing speech about the games. It's about the entity's right to engage in a commercial contract. And the courts, the two federal courts now have viewed this somewhat differently. And so that's been really frustrating because it just empowers this. Now, what's really interesting in a sense is that you singled out the NFL, the NBA, Major League Baseball as public as private institutions that you really wouldn't have any traction against. Oddly enough, in recent years, we've had better experiences dealing with these leagues than we have the NCAA. They've been more receptive to talking with us. And in recent weeks, as you're aware, and as maybe some listening are, might be aware, we've really gone after the NCAA in the sense of, look, we just want to sit down and meet with you. And they've sort of dodged the meeting over and over and over again and said, yeah, we'll meet with you in the future, we'll meet with you in the future, we'll meet with you in the future. But we've never gotten down to actually setting the time. We get the feeling we're being dodged. So ASNE and AAN and eight other organizations, including the SPLC, sent a letter to the NCAA finally basically, you know, demanding a meeting, saying, look, we know enough is enough. We're not trying to deal with simple provisions here. We want to talk about coverage issues. We want to talk about mutually benefiting our organizations and especially the fans and the public. And so we're hoping to get that meeting set up now at some point in the future. But, you know, again, it might just turn out to be empty promises to speak.
Right. And what concretely, I guess, might you aspire to get out of such a sit-down if you can actually get the decision-makers from the NCAA across the table?
Number one, a better understanding of their mutual needs. I think it does help to actually sit in a room with someone and understand what they really want instead of going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and doing it in a non-contentious manner. Ultimately, however, we want somebody – I think one of the areas is we want somebody to be accountable for the restrictions being placed on our members. When we see a problem, as we've seen in recent months, regarding restrictions being placed on a reporter, we find it hard to pin down somebody who can actually change the policy that's in place.
Right.
So you have, you know, for instance, the University of Washington kind of – cracked down a little bit on the Seattle Times and said you can only, this goes back to the live tweeting, you can only engage in so many updates during the game. And they pointed to the NCAA and said, you know, we're working off NCAA guidelines here. Well, if you go to the NCAA, they'll tell you, hey, we don't mandate any of this. It's up to the colleges and universities and the conferences to make the rules. You know, so they play off of each other, and it's a big game of whack-a-mole. Well, we want to actually sit down and whack the mole. And even if it's not a decisive blow, we'd like to understand where we should be swinging the hammer.
Right, and that's actually a good practical tip for the people who are listening. If you're a journalist and you're experiencing a restriction of this kind, you're being told you can't shoot video, you can't live blog, it's a really good question to try to get to the bottom of, well, whose rule is that exactly? Who is making that rule? Whose policy are you enforcing? Because just as Kevin is describing, there can be some buck passing going on here. You have several layers of possible decision makers. You've got the NCAA, you've got conferences, and then you've got the individual institution, each of which may have a set of policies, and each of which may point the finger at each other.
Yeah.
I'm interested, you know, we talked a little bit about the First Amendment and the possible theories there if you're dealing with a public actor on the other side. And, of course, I should mention, by the way, that there's real uncertainty about whether a conference or the NCAA, which are incorporated as private nonprofit entities, whether they're going to qualify as a government actor.
Right.
Anyway, that's a matter that there's some uncertainty about. But let's put the First Amendment aside. Are there other, it just seems like there's a bundle of possible legal issues here when you start talking about ownership of somebody's video and actually claiming that you own their photos and own their video. Seems like that raises copyright issues. There might be antitrust, there might be unfair business practice or unfair trade practice type of issues. Any other legal theories that you think might bear fruit if this actually turned into a confrontation?
Well, there's even trademark issues when that they'll use against you. The leagues or the conferences or the teams are most likely to raise trademark issues if you were to use their materials in the wrong way. Again, they'll raise a copyright issue and say that all you have is a license, and we're going to construe that license very narrowly to allow you to engage in news, editorial criticism, other non-commercial uses of the photo and video. But the fact remains, copyright vests in the person who fixed the original work of authorship. And that ain't the league. We learned way back, that ain't the team. We learned way back in 1997 in the NBA versus Motorola case that the NBA doesn't own the acts that happened during the game. They don't own the facts that come out of the acts that happened during the game. They don't own the statistics. And that was a big win from the Second Circuit on a sort of quasi-copyright, quasi-misappropriation theory that they tried to push. But it was, oddly enough, it was put forth against us this past weekend at Daytona when there was this big crash in the Saturday races. And, someone who had been in the stands now, word to the wise to all you out there, check the back of your ticket because it acts almost as a credential as well and restricts your rights too, even if you're not media. This is what happened is someone took video, as everybody does nowadays when something like this happens, and posted it to YouTube, and immediately NASCAR said, oh, no, take that down. We own the copyright. Check the back of your ticket. And so, they're claiming copyright. And a lot of people, I think, got a little sidetracked by saying, sort of conceding that port and saying, well, this is fair use. It's a newsworthy event. There's no way they should be able to keep people from posting that video. I mean, the first claim you would make in that instance is, I don't care what you're telling me about owning my owning my copyrights. There's no way you can take that from me. You do not own the acts. The way the back of that ticket was worded was a little inartful because it both seemed to claim what might be legitimate, and that I take a photo and you are saying that as a result of my entering your event, you own the, you acknowledge that I've taken the photo, you acknowledge that I have the copyright, but I'm transferring it to you as a condition of my entry. But there was also sort of an implication in that they just own, as I said, what they couldn't own, the acts themselves. And right from the start, that is clear, that they do not own every single thing that happens within the confines of that space and can't claim ownership in it. That, to me, is the biggest legal issue that needs to be resolved.
Yeah, yeah, and you mentioned the Motorola case, which just reaffirmed what the Copyright Act already says, which is as a prerequisite for something being protected by copyright, it has to be, and the Act itself says it's fixed in a tangible medium. In other words, it has to be frozen in some way, recorded, jotted down, taken down. And so the dribbling of the basketball that's taking place in front of your own eyes is not an act of copyright protected expression in some fashion, and you as the individual photographer or individual blogger, you own your own descriptions and images, and nobody can just sort of unilaterally assert ownership of those.
Exactly.
Well, one practical tip that I want to leave people with, especially sports journalists, if they're covering events at the pro or at the college level, is, and Kevin mentioned that these credentials can serve as legally binding contracts, that when you accept a credential and you sign your name on the dotted line, when you accept that pass, you may very well be entering into a contractual type of relationship with the institution that issues the credential, and so you want to be very careful about what you're signing and what you're what you may be committing, not only yourself but committing your news organization to. So if you're uncomfortable with any of those terms, you want to get a copy of them, maybe show them to a lawyer, at least be educated and be aware about what it is that you've just agreed to. Along those lines, Kevin, I mean, any other sort of practical terms or advice for people who feel like maybe they're being subjected to conditions beyond what the law or just sort of good common sense and judgment should allow?
Well, I think you've pointed out the biggest is that, you know, people need to actually read these credentials, and if they have any questions, they should familiarize themselves with some of the basic legal issues, or at least enough to raise their own red flags when they see potential problems, and know that, you know, it's a tough fight. It's really strange because we mentioned the word antitrust a little while ago, and what's strange is if AS&E or AAN or ONA or NAA were to stop and tell all its members, hey, we got credentials from the NCAA to cover this year's basketball tournament, you shouldn't sign them because of this, this, and this, we'd actually, you know, according to the NCAA, be committing an antitrust violation because we're you know, coordinating efforts amongst individuals to act in a concerted way that affects their business. That's a shorthand way of saying it. But we all know that the NCAA and the NFL and and Major League Baseball and NBA steal credentialing provisions from each other all the time and work together.
Sure.
I mean, it's the weirdest thing. So we can, you know, these organizations like, you know, the trade associations and organizations like SPLC are also great resources. We're not going to be able to dictate to you how you should respond, but we do have a treasure trove of past credentialing knowledge and even some credentialing provisions that we might be able to say to you, okay, you know, yeah, I think this is a problem. Now you have to decide just how far you're going to push it, because it's really tough. You know, are you going to be the one that takes the stand and says, I'm not going to cover this event because I just don't agree with it? Well, you may have to if you don't want to give that, you know, give up all your control. But there's very little you can do to push back other than, you know, every so often find the right situation to push back, make your voice known, maybe you get something out of it, and write about the issue and publicize the issue yourself. There's certainly going to be strength in numbers. It may not be a coordinated effort, but the more people you get on board, the stronger you're going to be in pushing back. And I want to say one more thing. I guess we're probably running short on time here, but, you know, this is not an issue limited to sports. So anybody who may not be interested in sports journalism, don't despair. You're probably getting screwed over as well. It's, you know, we see this all the time in concerts,
exactly,
award shows. I'm sure, I guarantee you the Oscars issued last night had the Academy Awards had a really restrictive credentialing agreement for the press that wanted to cover that. We see it now at not-for-profit fundraising events. We see them at gallery openings, art openings. So it's not sports. It's sports and entertainment. It's arts and culture. It's everything that you may want to cover, and somebody else wants to be able to control the images coming out of it. It could happen there as well. So I don't think this is just a sports issue. It's just been more high profile in the sports world.
Sure, sure. Well, let's leave it there, and I want, by way of wrap-up, to thank Kevin Goldberg, attorney with Fletcher Hildreth here in Arlington, Virginia, and counsel for the ASNE. I want to thank you for your leadership in putting together the coalition of media and First Amendment organizations that's putting pressure on the NCAA to come to the table and discuss issues of media access to sporting events. And just by way of wrap-up, for any of you who feel like you're experiencing any untoward restrictions on your ability to cover any type of a public event, let people like the ASNE and the SPLC know about it. Our website is www.splc.org. Our email is splc@splc.org. We hope you'll check out all the resources that the SPLC has to offer to help educate you about protecting your own legal rights. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next month.